Welcome back to the Wise Man's Page, the daily podcast where we read Patrick Rothfuss's The Wise Man's Fear, page by page. This is page 76. I could easily bring to mind the face of Cinder, his perfect smiling teeth, his white curling hair, his eyes black as beads of ink, his voice full of winter's chill, saying, "Someone's parents have been singing entirely the wrong songs." You would think these would be the worst memories, but you would be wrong. No, the worst memories were those of my young life, the slow roll and bump of riding in the wagon, my father holding the reins loosely, his strong hands on my shoulders showing me how to stand on the stage so my body said proud or sad or shy, his fingers adjusting mine on the strings of his lute, my mother brushing my hair, the feel of her arms around me, the perfect way my head fit into the curve of her neck, how I would sit curled in her lap next to the fire at night, drowsy and happy and safe. These were the worst memories, precious and perfect, sharp as a mouthful of broken glass. I lay in bed, clenched into a trembling knot, unable to sleep, unable to turn my mind to other things, unable to stop myself from remembering again and again and again. Then there came a small tapping at my window, a sound so tiny I didn't notice it until it stopped. Then I heard the window ease open behind me. "Close," Ari said softly. I clenched my teeth against the sobbing and lay still as I could, hoping she would think I was asleep and leave. "Close," she called again. "I brought you." There was a moment of silence. Then she said, "Oh." I heard a soft sound behind me. The moonlight showed her tiny shadow on the wall as she climbed through the window. I felt the bed move as she settled onto it. A small, cool hand brushed the side of my face. "It's okay," she said quietly. "Come here." I began to cry quietly, and she gently uncurled the tight knot of me until my head lay in her nap. She gently uncurled the tight knot of me until my head lay in her lap. She murmured, brushing my hair away from my forehead, her hands cool against my hot face. "I know," she said sadly. "It's bad sometimes, isn't it?" She stroked my hair gently, and it only made me cry harder. I could not remember the last time someone had touched me in a loving way. "I know," she said. "You have a stone in your heart, and some days it's so heavy there is nothing to be done. But you don't have to be alone for it. You should have come to me. I understand." My body clenched, and suddenly the taste of plum filled my mouth again. "I miss her," I said before I realized I was speaking. Then I bit it off before I ended the page. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Jordana.
I'm Nick. I'm a little disappointed that Quoth needs to be drugged and to have a flashback to taste plum again in order to access these emotions and be honest. And it continues on the next page.
Well, so there's an interesting, like, normally I would agree with you, but in the case of Quoth, who really, like, he doesn't have the connections normal people would have. If Quoth was a normal person, then of course, like, yes, he should be able to access emotions like that. But the thing is, like, even the people Quoth is close to, he's not that close to. He doesn't allow himself to be close to people for lots of reasons. So this actually falls into character for me. Like, this makes sense to me.
Yeah, like,
because it's exactly who Quoth is.
Not only that, but he's a deeply traumatized person who has buried his trauma. He does his, like, the whole point of this is that he has forced these feelings, like, down into his subconscious so he doesn't have to think about them because they're so painful. But he can't do that now, so they're being dredged up. Like, that tells us that, oh, Quoth is a traumatized person who does feel these things deeply and has been deeply hurt by them and has buried them.
Go ahead.
I was going to say this, like, from what we just saw of Sim and what we're now seeing of Auri, is that Quoth chose the right people to be friends with.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, like, also, even though he doesn't trust everyone with everything, he has, like, picked people to be around him who are the right kinds of people that he needs.
Yeah.
So that if he does end up in a situation where he, like, ends up opening up, he's not at a loss.
And, like, part of Quoth's character is that he doesn't trust people, right? He like, but I think because of his experiences in Tarbian, he's like, you know, he had all of that beaten out of him. So he's, even with people who he considers his friends, who he cares about, he's deeply mistrustful of like letting his walls down around them, which is why Auri in her own way sort of chastises him and says like, you could have come to me. You know, you don't have to like be the brooding tough guy who, you know, doesn't talk about his feelings. You know, you could have shared this with me. I would have understood.
I think the reason that he doesn't share with Auri though, is because he doesn't want to burden her. I don't think that he doesn't trust Auri. I think that he wants to protect her from himself.
That might be what he tells himself. I think that that might be part of the reason, but it might not be the whole reason.
And that's why I'm disappointed, because I would have hoped that by now Quoth would start to understand that he has these close friendships and that it wouldn't be burdensome to open up to them about these things.
How long has he been at the university?
I think of it as being about a year, but
that's not a lot of time to trust people.
Well, hang on. I have another insight I want to attach to that. And that's kind of in keeping with what you guys were saying, that he doesn't even understand himself that he's keeping these things down. And that's why it takes the Plumbob for them to come up and access them. Like, yeah. He doesn't even know he's avoiding thinking about these things, that he has this sadness inside him.
Yeah, like, do traumatized people, are they always super aware of like, oh, I have repressed memories of my terrible childhood that I have chosen to bury? No, I think a lot of traumatized people don't even realize that they have those feelings or that they have buried them. Or they might rationalize it away as saying like, oh, it doesn't actually affect me that much, until it comes out in, you know, at points of stress.
And all at once.
And also, let us keep in mind that Quoth is 15 years old. And 15-year-old people are not the most emotionally mature. So even if he did have that understanding, he might not, you know, he doesn't have the tools that we as jaded 30-somethings have to like address our emotional traumas.
Yes, I agree with all of those things.
This is the day in Slow Regard of Silent Things that is taken up by, on a single page, and it says on the fourth day, Auri wept. I'm looking for my copy to confirm it. Can I?
Well, while Nick is looking for that, here. While Nick is looking for that, I do just want to point out that pursuant to something we were discussing on yesterday's page, the worst memories for Quoth, the ones that actually hurt him, are remembering like the last time he was perfectly, truly happy, which is when he was a child and his parents were alive and loved him. Like, that's the last time he felt really safe. That's the last time he felt truly loved. That's why those memories hurt, right?
Yeah. It's what you don't have that you miss.
Yes.
That makes sense.
I wonder what the stone that is in Auri's heart is. I think that is a mystery that we might not even have known existed until this page. What is the trauma that made Auri the way she is?
It's definitely uncharacteristically mature of her to take this role of the nurturing figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely
I actually disagree.
Okay.
So I think that Auri has always been this mature, but there's a difference between like being shy and protective of yourself the way she is when she's kind of running away from stuff. And like at this point she now has the trust in Quoth that she doesn't have to do that other thing that she did before, but that other thing doesn't make her immature. Like, she was always both of those things. It's just, she did the other one first, because it, like, she needed to protect herself.
Yeah, that's a good insight.
Like, none of the things that Auri does really strike me as childish. Like, I know that she is childlike because she is small and she is light on her feet and she says insightful things, but the fact that children say insightful things without knowing it is not actually a childlike thing. It is just a thing. And it's certainly not a sign of immaturity.
Yeah, I guess my take is slightly different in that I do think of Auri as being childlike, but I don't think of her as being immature.
Okay. I can accept that read.
You don't have to. You can fight me on it. That's
no,
what this podcast
I'm,
is
no,
all about.
I'm good with that read because I don't think childlike and immaturity are the same thing. And therefore, this moment isn't really a moment of her being more mature. I don't think it's like a moment of her being less childlike either, because this is totally a thing a kid would do.
Yeah, it's true. Kids are empathetic. Kids would comfort someone, you know, they even like, you know, a parent or an authority figure, you know, kids, when they see someone sad, they want to comfort them usually.
Yeah.
There's one line on this page I want to highlight because it supports a theory I have long held. I could not remember the last time someone had touched me in a loving way. I don't think that this scene is suggesting that there is any sexual or romantic love going on between the two of them, but I think it's undeniable that there is real love happening here. And I strongly feel that Auri is the first real lover that Quoth talks about in the beginning of Name of the Wind.
It's just not a romantic love.
Yeah, and I've said this before, and that she's the one who will name him Dulator.
Yeah, I think that this debate really hinges on the connotations inherent in the word lover.
I think real is the word that matters there.
Well, I'm not going to spend 15 minutes debating which of two words in a sentence is the important one.
What are you doing on this podcast then? That's our mandate.
Okay, then. Well, I'm going to say lover has implication. Like, the word lover implies romantic and or sexual love. Like,
disagree. In itself. Hard disagree. No, wrong. Incorrect.
It doesn't just mean one who loves.
It does. It also means that. It means both.
Somebody want to pull out a dictionary?
Yes, no. I'm doing it right now. Lover, a person having a sexual or romantic relationship with someone, often outside marriage, is
all right,
the definition
well,
of lover.
No. We need the diegetic dictionary.
What's
the
dictionary?
That's why I think the word real is important, because sure, there's like all the sexual and romantic love that Quoth experiences, but the most real love, the person who is the most real lover of him, is Auri.
I think if that's the
genuinely
sense
loves
meant,
him for himself and for and with no expectation.
I think if that's the sense he meant, then he wouldn't have used the word lover.
I think he's couching it in the word real lover so that short-sighted morons will look for a sexual partner.
Well, if that's the sense, then that's a nasty cheap trick.
I mean, I think we can all agree that Rothfuss has and will play a few nasty tricks on us.
Well, can we play a nasty trick on Dradanna by reaching into the gullet of Mr. Mailbag?
Hate you.
Oh, Jeremy, you want to come inside of me?
I do, Mr. Mailbag. I do wish to come inside of you. I wish to reach my arm into your maw and retrieve today's letter.
Oh, shoulder deep. Oh.
This is a letter from I.W. Ferguson labeled Thanks, and it reads as follows. Hey, thanks for the recommendation about B. Cumberbatch's behind-the-scenes thing on YouTube. I did enjoy it, though bittersweet, as it reignited the deep sense of loss I still feel about the drop in quality from the Lord of the Rings films to The Hobbit. Clearly, it was not for lack of resources, time, or dragon voice talent. Also, Nick, the last two fantasy ASMRists recommendations I sent have not continued working, but Whisperwind ASMR is my new favorite. It has been very prolific. I think her best might be this one, linked below. Whisperwind Monster Hunter Part 4, Steampunk Inventor, Getsy Weapons and Armor. Thanks, IW. There has never been a better time to watch people speaking softly to you on YouTube, seeing as we're all social distancing.
I didn't know there was like a whole subgenre of like fantasy themed ASMR.
Oh yeah, it's deep. There's at least one. There's an ASMRist I like called Goodnight Moon has kind of a universe. She has a fantasy universe that has like a map. And each of the videos, kind of the theme that ties them together is that you are kind of going on a journey and you're stopping at various places along the way of the journey. and you're meeting the different people there, and they speak softly to you and give you tingles. It's
that
great.
That sounds like super cool, but I also don't really like ASMR is a weird one because like I love like having someone read a fantasy story to me. I love audiobooks, but I can't stand ASMR.
Well, if you don't get the tingles, then it does nothing for you.
It's just obnoxious
you, right?
People whispering.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the ASMR artist makes a big difference because some of them just sort of like have a naturally comforting or friendly countenance. And that goes a long way. Also, some of them are really high budget. I wonder, especially Goodnight Moon, I wonder where she gets the budget. I wonder if they're like secret backdoor viral marketing for something, although I don't see any obvious products.
Does she have a Patreon?
Maybe you should
ask
her.
She does have a Patreon, but she came out of the gate with a really high budget.
Ooh.
Like if I were predisposed to weird conspiracy theories, I might suggest that she was like a virtual celebrity packaged by a corporation or something.
Is it not possible that someone might have a lot of audio skills prior to becoming a ASMR artist?
Yeah, no, it is possible. It's not just audio. Like her costumes and her sets are really top notch.
Like ContraPoints level?
Better.
Wow.
Like TV grade.
Okay, but consider the following. If you are the kind of person who works at a theater, like in the tech room, you A, have all those skills, and B, have friends who have resources.
It's true. It's a possibility.
That's possible.
I want to also talk a little bit about Lord of the Rings to The Hobbit and why there was the distinct drop in quality. And I think we can all agree. I don't think anybody would disagree that The Hobbit movies are not as good as the Lord of the Rings movies. And I think it's a bit like the difference between the original Star Wars trilogy or even the first two Star Wars and Return of the Jedi, which is markedly worse, fight me, and the prequels, because the first movies were made by an underdog. They were
I want to yes and this.
Okay.
Because yes, they were made by an underdog, but also they were labors of love. Like the first Lord of the Rings movies, no one expected them to succeed. So Peter Jackson was more or less left alone. And he really, really, really wanted to make them. And he spent, and his crew and his, you know, his fellow writers and producers had a lot of like time to like get it right. Whereas when he made the Hobbit movies, he did not want to make them. He passed it off to Guillermo del Toro, who ended up not being able to make them for various reasons, but Warner Brothers had sunk so much money into it that they like needed to get them out there. So they went back to Peter Jackson and said, like, we really need you to make these movies. And he was like, okay, fine. And then they were like, and they have to be three movies, and they have to like have this, that, and the other thing, and you have like no time at all to make them. So they didn't have nearly the same amount of like time to plan them out, and Peter Jackson's heart really wasn't in it. And he decided, like, I think the studio's concession to him was that he could use this like weird 48 frames technology on them. And then, and you can just see all through that movie, like the places where they cut corners, the places where things feel rushed. And conversely, you can see the places where they clearly spent a lot of time because those things still look good. Like the dragon looks great and Gollum looks great, but like the white orc looks like dog shit.
I didn't know all that. I didn't know about the sunk cost. I was dimly aware that they had attempted to make them with Guillermo del Toro, which would have been better movies, I think, because Guillermo is, I'm going to say more of an auteur than Peter Jackson. I think he has a more clear, distinct artistic intentionality behind his films.
I mean, there's a special feature on the third movie's DVD where Peter Jackson like gets to the point where he has to film the battle scene, and he realizes that he has no plan. He has no idea what to do. So they have to shut down production for like a few weeks while he like puts together a storyboard because he has no idea what he's doing.
It makes me really lament the lack of a Guillermo movie, because The Hobbit being smaller, more character driven, I think that's more Guillermo's bag.
I posit that this needs to be its own episode because I would love to invite Jeff to this conversation as well because I can see him in the background.
All right. Well, maybe that can be our Patreon episode for May, talking about why the Hobbit movies suck.
Sweet. Okay.
So let's set that up and then we will get back to you tomorrow for another page
of
The Wind.